ladies, gentlemen, Joes, creepy crawlies, paleontologists/botanists, chaoticians, anthropomorphized dogs, mice, and cats, and dinosaurs.
You got one for each.
Cavemen, gremlins, cowboys, drag queens, and men in black. And, of course, to all you ramblers out there, welcome back to Ramblin' and Amblin' Podcast, the podcast where we go through every film in the Amblin' Entertainment canon, the production company founded by Steven Spielberg, Frank Marshall, and Kathleen Kennedy back in 1981. Mm-hmm. I am one half of your host, Andy Godian.
And the other half, Joshua Glenn.
And you join us for a very special episode today as we have come to the end of the 1990s. And with that, it's time to review the decade that has been. The so far most prolific decade in Amblin's history, with a total of 29 movies. The Hawkeye among you may have seen literally in the last week that Deep Impact has been added to that list. We're not counting it because it never used to be there. From digging,
very frustrating.
The way I've found out, I think why it's on there now is because the copyright has just reverted back to Amblin because DreamWorks has gone a bit up there.
Yeah,
so I'm not sure it counts.
So maybe I don't know. Maybe we'll try and incorporate it at some point in the future.
Yeah,
maybe. But it was so close to it that it's all the more irritating that it's slightly scurried our record a little bit.
We ever do that DreamWorks series, and it will be covered. But yes, I'm sure you can understand why we're not doubling, just stepping back and going like, actually, here's Deep Impact. But screw you, Wikipedia, and whoever added that. But I'm very excited to get into this episode.
Yes.
For long-time listeners, you may remember we gave the 1980s the same treatment back when we finished that decade. But for those of you who weren't around for that episode, go back, give a listen. It's pretty funny.
We had a good time.
We had a good time.
Hopefully that translated.
But basically what we've, for those of you that aren't familiar, what we've done here is we've come up with a list of categories together to work through some of the our favourite bits and pieces of the 1990s offerings from Amblin Entertainment.
In keeping with the expanded and slightly bloated slate of films in the 90s, we have also added four new categories to our slate of categories.
For we have a couple of a name for these like little awards. Ramblies, the Moonies. The Ramblies is probably the best one, isn't it? There's something about the Moonies that I quite like.
Conjures up images of naked bottoms.
But before we get on with that, Joshua Glenn, would you like some stats from the decade that
has
just been?
I would love some stats, please, Andrew.
Okie dokie. So as I said, that's 29 movies from 1990 to 1999, with a box office totaling $5.68 billion. Woo! The highest grossing being?
JP.
Jurassic Park, of course. Now, do you know what the lowest grossing was? The paltry $1.49 million.
It's either A Dangerous Woman or In Dreams. I forget which. Dangerous Woman.
Dangerous Woman, yeah, indeed. Yeah. It just got nothing.
just pipped In Dreams to the bottom.
Mm-hmm. 16 Academy Awards. 7 of those belonging to Schindler's List. Mm-hmm. 32,400. Hang on. No, that can't be right. 3,248 minutes of committed film.
Yes.
The longest being Saving Private Ryan. Oh, no, Schindler's List, sorry, with 195 minutes.
Mm.
Can you guess what the shortest was at 71 minutes?
Either We're Back or in one of the Amblimations or Fievel.
Yes, indeed.
We're back?
We're back. We're back indeed. And how many minutes of dedicated podcast time to these 29 minutes? So bear in mind the 3,248 minutes for how much movie there is.
I feel like your original 30 plus thousand is correct. Because if Schindler's List is 195 minutes long and there's 29 films, I know they're not all that long, but most of them average at about 120.
Maybe.
Hang on a second.
No, that was still. No, I think 3,248 is the right number.
Yeah. Okay. Man, I can't do quick math. I reckon, goddamn, so we're averaging around about. It must be not dissimilar. I wonder if most of our episodes are longer than the films.
Talking. There's certainly some that are.
For Men in Black, we added a whole extra hour.
Yep.
Some might question why. I reckon it's about 4,125.
You did this last time as well. You went much higher than the actual runtime of movies. We're still below the runtime of movies. We're 3,060 minutes of a podcast time. We'll see how long this episode ends up being, because then it might take over. But yes, for every bumper Men in Black episode we had one where A Dangerous Woman, that was only an hour long.
God, we were really, really scraping the barrel with
there
that.
Wasn't much to do with that movie. But we may as well just kind of crack on with what everyone's here for, at least what we're here for.
And we do try to mitigate the innate self-indulgence of this kind of thing. Because we've been immersed in this decade for what feels like an eternity. It feels like...
It's been nearly...
Very much has been longer than the first.
No, it's been just a year and a half, right?
I think we kept to our bi-weekly schedule pretty much for the first decade. It was in the second that we started to slip a little bit. So, for reasons intentional or not, we have been in here for much longer.
A lot of things have happened during that time.
Yeah.
Moved house. Got engaged.
And part of this also, if anyone is listening to this that hasn't heard all the episodes, which you may not have, given that some of them are long. I like to use this as a chance to shine a light on films that maybe
you've
extra eyes on them.
There's some things that you're like, oh, I didn't say that in the episode.
All I can say to you, my friend, is I'm sorry, Sarah Cook.
Uh-oh. So yeah, I'd like to think that this is a, like you say, it's a chance to kind of shine a light again on the things that we've really loved from this past decade. And also, it's a big decade for what is this whole run. And it's time to give it its kind of due diligence.
Yeah.
And not that we haven't over 29 movies, but like, I think it's such a significant point in this studio's history. And starts to bring in what is about to be a even weirder kind of point in its kind of output. And to... This is the glory days of Amblin, I'd argue, the 1990s. So I think we've got to go out with a big Wallapalooza.
A Wallapalooza. Could not have said it better myself. So,
Joshua Glenn, would you like to take us off?
I would absolutely love to. So we're going to start things off with a brand new category we brought in for the 1990s. And that is the most representative Amblin moment.
Mm-hmm.
Andrew.
Yes.
What was your vote?
So try to think of kind of how to take this. And so we've often, like with each episode, we ask our guests, like, what does Amblin mean to you? And kind of like, what the vibe, what the tone of that is. So I took this category to kind of mean that. Yes. Which kind of moment best encapsulates that vibe and that feeling. And this is a decade where you have films that fall into that vibe quite easily and you have some that don't. But for me, this was a very easy answer.
I wonder if you and I picked the same.
I've gone for My Dear Dr. Grant, My Dear Dr. Sattler. Welcome to Jurassic Park, Brachiosaurus scene, soaring music, seeing everything out there.
They're moving in herds.
They do move in herds. Because that is a moment that exemplifies kind of like technical wizardry. Or something that is so overwhelming and like beyond your wildest dreams to kind of see a dinosaur alive in the flesh for the first time in one of the early scenes of a film, which is so epitomizes for anyone who's like got even a passing interest in film. If they hear Steven Spielberg, Jurassic Park's going to be one of the first ones that jumps to mind, and it's because of big iconic moments like that, which really encapsulate, I think, Amblin for me. Particularly being a film which has been in my life for much as long as I can remember.
That's the crucial thing, because this is the decade in which you and I were born. So a lot of these films we have first-hand, very formative memories and associations with. So I picked the same scene as well.
It really felt like it, didn't it?
Specifically, really like as he sort of slowly stands in the Jeep and he takes his glasses off and he grabs Ellie's head and turns
Spielberg
it around.
Faces.
Among the best use of Spielberg face, because the audience is also displaying that face watching.
And kind of like trickling horns from John Williams.
It is just, you know, goose pimply hair standing up kind of stuff. And it does, it just sums up the sense of wonder and seeing new, exciting things, worlds, creatures.
It's also just seen even outside of Amblin. It's just something that encapsulates what, like, good blockbuster filmmaking can do. And what, like, really
you'll believe a man can fly, kind of idea.
That kind of thing. So there's going to be quite a few honourable mentions in other categories here, but for me, this was one that didn't really ever have anything else in contention.
No, neither. I suppose I may have considered, you know what the difference is between you and me?
Yeah.
I'll make this look good. Mm. But I just think that realistically, it's got to be this. Yeah. Has to be this.
Agreed.
Oh.
Put your head between your knees.
Dr. Grant, my dear Dr. Sattler, welcome to Jurassic Park.
They do move in herds. How'd you do this? I'll show you.
Moving swiftly on to a category that we did have in our original run.
Yes.
We'll let you know whenever a new one pops out. But this is for best surprise of the decade. And you said there, but this is the decade where both of us were born, and this is where some movies that we were really started to, like, movies that were really part of our childhood, particularly towards the end of the decade.
Yeah.
But there's also a lot of, like, weirder, smaller, lesser seen movies within this batch that are a bit harder to pinpoint, well, at any point when you might have ever have come across them, really, because either they don't have a massive cultural footprint or they've just been kind of lost to the ether and written off as, like, kind of just something that didn't do very well and no one's really kind of come back to in any way. So this decade definitely had more of that than the 80s did. So I think there was more capacity for surprise.
More zigzagging, more peaks and troughs.
Mm-hmm. So Joshua Glenn, what was your biggest surprise?
Well, this is a film. The film is linked inextricably to the context of it, in terms of watching it and the discussion we had and the guests we had. The whole package was a delightful, unexpected surprise. Found the film affecting in ways that I just was completely blindsided by. And the conversation brought an old friend back into my life in the most delightful, illuminating way. And it was just, I go back to that one quite often, and it warms the cockles. And it's The Bridges of Madison County, which I can see one day, because, have you picked that one as well?
Two for two in the same, that's answer one, so far.
That's what I can see becoming a favourite, a genuine all-time favourite over time. Just the emotional breadth and maturity and sensitivity that a film had. It's a name I've said in the episode that I associated with very middling pedestrian, you know, the grey audience, shall we say. But the film was just staggering, staggering work. And we had Rob Yeomans on the episode, who's an old friend from back home that I haven't seen since I was about 18 years old. And he was just a joy. And the feeling of discovering something with someone else and them taking as much joy in your joy as you took from the thing that you experienced was very special. And that episode probably makes me the most emotional out of them all, because it was just such a, you know, journey of discovery between of us.
I that's a very sweet answer. It is my answer as well. I had two kind of in contention, but ultimately this was the one that won out, largely because it was the one that I hadn't seen out of the two. My other one that was thinking about was Joe versus a Volcano, because it was completely the movie I didn't think it was from when I saw it for the first time, back when I was like 14. But it really had to be Bridges of Madison County, largely because for the same reason you were pointing towards there, I had a very I had a very strict idea in my head of what I thought it was, and was really not expecting to get much out of it at all. It looked quite dry on the surface.
Sounds dry.
And like Clint Eastwood's also a very erratic filmmaker in terms of like quality. You never quite know what Eastwood you're gonna get.
Yeah.
But that thankfully was a Eastwood gem. That, like you say, I can see that one being something to come back to as you get older in life as well, and only getting more powerful, more pertinent to your own experience. So, yeah.
Clint Eastwood, Meryl Streep.
You want me to stop? Tell me now.
The Bridges of Madison County, rated PG-13, starts June 2nd at theaters everywhere.
2 for 2, agreed.
I know for a fact that we're going to disagree on
that.
I'd be very surprised if you and I overlapped on this one. The next category, as listeners might recall, is favourite score. Now, I think it's very important to stress that we emphasise favourite as opposed to best. And that is a thread that I'm going to return to throughout the episode, because it is to do with one's emotional attachment. That's kind of what we see Amblin as. It's an emotional investment we have in this.
Yeah, that's fair.
You know, the idea of what Amblin... I don't want to say brand, that's a bit too cynical and corporate-y, but the idea of what Amblin represents. He's got a very emotional attachment. So, with that in mind, Andrew, what is your favourite Amblin score? Or it might also be what you think is the best.
It was a hard one, this one. There's a lot of really great scores in this decade. You got some great work from James Horner throughout it. I very nearly went with Casper. Very nearly went with Mask of Zorro. Jerry Goldsmith's doing some absolutely wild shit in Gremlins 2. Kazoo's at the wazoo. And I also have a lot of fondness for the Western tones of that Silvestri's bringing to Back to the Future Part 3 as well. He's having a... And I often think about the drum... The
ZZ Top spinning the drum. Woo!
I often think about that. But as I'm wondering if it was going to end up being the case in every single decade review, it always comes down to a John Williams score for me.
Some things are just unavoidable.
I love the Hook score. That's not the one I've gone with.
Good.
I love the Schindler's List score. I think it's very beautiful.
Hmm.
And I do love the Jurassic Park score.
Hmm.
A triumphant theme. Very glorious. And
a lot of
joy. But I've not gone with Jurassic Park for my favourite score. I've gone with The Lost World. Jurassic Park.
That's my favourite score.
Because I think it like encapsulates the spirit of what I think that film is largely going for. However, arguably, it is successful at it or not. And as in, it's not going for the kind of clean approach of a sequel. It's going for something a bit moodier and a bit darker and a bit grimmer, and there's just something really, really enveloping or inviting and quite beautifully ominous about the travel to the, like Malcolm's travel to the island theme, that there's the kind of new theme that he brings in for that I love so much. And like one of my happiest days in the last couple of years is when I realised that the Lost World score had finally been uploaded to Spotify. But even beyond that kind of new theme that he brings in for it, which has I just love the way that it kind of layers in the bassoons at the start. I'll put in a clip of it because it's very hard to kind of describe it. Like burnum, 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 and then you have kind of like an adventure theme, but it's not in the same kind of vibe of the original theme at all. It's something that is much more inquisitive and much more
like
ominous, and it's much more. there's a lot more danger in it, because you know that something's going to go wrong here, despite the fact that it is embarking on an adventure. Yeah. And also just then beyond that later in like kind of like the raptor attack scenes, it's the most like percussion heavy John Williams score for like years. There's a lot of his kind of like more 70s jazz influence stuff that builds in a bit more percussion, but it's something like the particular way the banjo line drives a lot of the action beats in the latter half, which is just some of the more inventive kind of action scoring that John Williams has ever done, like to like compare it, like Stars, which is more in a kind of grand orchestra mold. This is just more kind of like primal and propulsive action score. And I just think it's a very, very underrated bit of John Williams score. So I wanted to go with that.
I like that. My God, I was thinking the whole time, it's obviously going to be Jurassic Park, but then in your prelude to your announcement, I realized you were going to do a little switch there. But you have said in the past, I think even with Jack on the episode, you said, and I think he said too, that it's your favourite score of Williams's.
Of those two.
This is much more of an Andy category than me. You're much more plugged into scores, and you're much more versed. Pun intended. So my approach was much more, again, emotional.
Yeah.
A lot of what I feel and what this thing does to me than anything else. So I probably, in an objective sense, maybe I would have gone for Jurassic Park, and I almost did go for Jurassic Park.
It's a banger of a theme.
It's a banger. Much like how E.T. was both of our picks decade. Yeah. Pretty unavoidable. I also briefly had Danny Elfman's score for Men in Leather, because that is cool as shit. Yeah, it sets a mood, immediately sets a mood, and it takes you eyes. But then again, it is mainly that one main motif that kind of sticks out. But the one I went for ultimately is one that has sort of seen this film stitched into my life throughout various important chapters. It's something that actually brought me and the guest on the episode a bit closer during university, and it's something that I only have to hear.
I figured it would probably
be. Yeah. And it also, my aim on that episode and in this episode is to rehabilitate the reputation of this film a little bit, because it's not one that's seen as canonical in Amblin's filmography, let alone in 90s films in general.
Yeah.
But this score, it plays my heart like it's a little xylophone, and it makes me very susceptible to tears. And that is James Horner's score for Casper. Yeah. I think it's a beautiful piece of work.
It's brilliant. It's brilliant. It's great. Casper's Lullaby is such a...
It's haunting and slightly disquieting, deeply, deeply sad, pure, innocent, and so much of what keeps that film afloat and stitches together the two vastly disparate tonalities in there is the work that James Horner does. Mm-hmm. And if you haven't heard the episode, do go back and give it a listen, because I know you and Mike do get much more into the specifics of why that score is so effective and James Horner's approach to it. But for now, for me, for this, what I will say is it makes me feel things in a way that none of the other scores of this decade are able to do so. And yes, part of that is because it was a big film in my childhood and it's stayed with me throughout my life. But I just can't deny that it's a major piece of work, I think.
Fully agreed.
And a film that deserves more love.
Yeah.
Thank you.
yeah. And then was it sticking in the oral realm with the next category. Favorite use of a popular song. In the previous decade, we kind of described this not as a song written for the film
as such,
but a song that already existed, and they like went, oh, like that.
Yeah.
Put that on a soundtrack.
Repurposed, reuse, recycle. Yeah, because it's too easy otherwise if it's one written for the film.
I'm intrigued to see what you've put, because I might have slightly cheated with mine.
So. Oh, interesting. I think when we were talking, Andy and I met at the pub to hash out the, you know, structure of the episode a few weeks ago. And as soon as we got to this one, you said you had something in mind. You knew what it was going to be straight away after a moment of thinking. I wonder if you'd have gone for the same, but having heard you say that,
yeah,
I don't know if we will have.
Yeah, and you're allowed to be like, no, I don't think you can have that when I say it.
But you can justify it well enough.
Yeah, okay. I'm intrigued to hear what you have to say first.
So I'll start with the honourable mention. Okay. I think one of the more wicked and pointed uses of music was Wannabe by Spice Girls.
Yeah, yeah. In That's one of my honourable mentions.
Yeah. And Kiki Dunst's line about... how this is a torture method.
Yeah.
But the one that I went for in the end is it's the opening credits song to a film that was, again, a delightful surprise that has lodged itself in my personal canon of feel-good pick-me-up movies, because it immediately gets you in the mood for what the film's going to offer, and the film more than follows up. Yeah. And that, of course, is I Am the Body Beautiful by Salt and Pepper from Tu Wong Fu. Thanks for everything.
Ready or not, here comes Mama.
I am body beautiful.
Yeah, I remember being in that moment when that started.
Yeah.
When we were watching that, I was just like, that's
rarely has a song so perfectly teed you up for what the film is going to give you. And rarely, even still, more rare still, has the film followed through on that and given it so satisfyingly.
Ready or not, here comes Mama.
And where is the body? And where is the body? Move over, mother, 'cause I'm going faster than you can drive. The body, beautiful.
So that's mine. So what? But clearly, you.
Well, that is my kind of like honourable mention. That if you reject what I've got to offer, then
what could you go for though?
And another honourable mention, another one I had was Wannabe, as you mentioned there. Another one I had was Eric Bruden's cover of 16 Tons from the opening credit sequence of Joe vs. Volcano.
Because
it's quite a weird version of that song for what this weird kind of Fritz Langian dystopic opening.
What a striking movie that is.
But what I've gone for, and this is why it's contentious... favorite use of a proper song from Andy Goody in the 90s is Men in Black sampling Forget Me Not by Patrice Rushen. Now, discuss. Is it allowed?
The title of this category is Favorite Use of a Popular Song.
And they do
it. Doesn't specify who is using it and in what capacities. Yeah. I think that is allowed.
And it's great, right?
I think that's brilliant. You found a way to make it Will Smith Men in Black without it being Will Smith Men in Black. You swine.
Walk with me.
No, great. Yeah.
I'm glad you're allowing that.
Bravo. Any more you care to say on the topic?
It's just like, it's one of those things that really epitomizes the coolness of that film, that tie-in single and the tie-in album, and just that use of that particular riff and rewording it to such a cool, propulsive Using that word again. That's my word of the day.
You catch yourself, don't you, when we do these recordings, repeating certain things.
But yeah, I think it just really epitomizes the spirit of it. Just very cool, just very very fun, very funky.
Yeah.
Got a lot of memories of that, particularly that music video.
With Dancing with Mikey.
Dancing with Mikey.
Yeah.
That used to be on Top of the Pops a lot, I can remember.
It's such a weird choice because you've seen it about 20 times by the time you go watch the movie in the cinema. You're mates with Mikey. Hey, he's a good friend of mine. And then he gets exploded in the first 5 minutes of the movie.
Sorry.
Mikey. MIBs, here come the MIBs. Here come the men in black. So to switch from the aural to the visual then, Andrew, the next category is favourite looking movie. And this is our way of cheekily combining a few different categories, I suppose, and giving us a chance to think holistically as opposed to either just in terms of cinematography or set design. Anything else. So, how do you interpret this category and what's your choice?
The way I kind of come to this one is, like you say, it's like kind of taking that blend of cinematography, production design, costume design, and just kind of trying to land on something that all those elements together help bring the film to life and kind of help it have a kind of... distinctual visual flavor that stays with you, and there's lots of great cinematographers working throughout this decade. Couple of my honorable mentions, I was impressed with just quite how striking Thomas Newton Siegel's work on The Trigger Effect is. It has that really like great kind of bold colored 90s thriller vibe.
Some good greens,
as does gotten his name now, in Dreams, Darius Wolski. Darius Koji.
Yeah, I think that's what it is.
For a similar reason, that has a very striking, overblown autumnal look to it that gives it a very unique flavor. This is also the first decade that Janusz Kaminski and Steven Spielberg collaborate, the first one being Schindler's List, and then From this point on, it's Kaminski. Kaminski also shot Little Giants.
That's the one mention Little Giants is going to get. Yeah.
But ultimately, it came down to two movies for me in terms of like thinking about how set design, costume design, and cinematography kind of work to build an identity that like really helps sell the movie. My kind of close runner-up is Men in Black, just for Rip Baker's work on the alien designs. Donald Peterman's work as DP. He's one of Sonnenfeld's guys for at least that early start of his career. But ultimately, the one I went with is the one that's got like the most kind of seared look in my mind of just like a very strong visual identity, largely because it's also a film that has to build a brand within the world of the movie itself. And that is Jurassic Park. Just the kind of soft, almost quite soft color palette that Dean Cundey's bringing on the DOP side of things. And then just down to how everyone looks. Everyone's got a really distinctive look. There's like Alan Grant in his safari hat and red necktie and blue shirt and Laura Dern in the pink shirt and chino shorts. Dr. Ian Malcolm dressed entirely in black in this tropical jungle. Muldoon with his khaki shorts and mighty fine calves.
He must work out.
Yes. And then the look of the park itself, right down from that logo to even the way the Ford Explorers look.
Yeah.
And then it even beyond that, just how you shift from kind of day to night in that movie and how kind of lovely and kind of comforting the daylight is, and then just how kind of suddenly in the horror of everything going wrong that the wet and stormy nighttime brings. And it's just, yeah, it's just one of those films that has that distinct visual look that no other film quite, like,
yeah,
even like anything else in the series just never recaptures it. Because I think it's such a particular look to that particular yeah. point in time that you're making that movie.
Yeah.
So yeah, for me it was JP.
No brainer in hindsight.
Yeah.
Absolutely spectacular design. Spared no expense.
Yeah, so mine was also between two. The one that I really struggled to not have, which I've given the top prize in other categories just so I can talk about it again. But I thought Joe versus the Volcano, particularly.
Yeah, that had a really distinct
Stephen Goldblatt's work, Steepy, on that one. That film was so much more expressionistic, like weaving together all these different filmmakers that felt like a bit of Gilliam here, a bit of Peter Greenaway there, that kind mm-hmm. of. As close to an art movie as Amblin would release. That's a very visually striking film. And that's another one that I'm very excited to revisit again in the yeah. future and glean more from. Also, must mention Saving Private Ryan, particularly obviously the battle scenes that we spoke about in the episode. Yeah. Pretty revolutionary and a lot of ripple effects on there. But the favourite looking movie, I think, is just such an undeniable splendour and unified aesthetic. And that is one you mentioned in your honourable mentions. It's Men in Black.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a perfect fusion of, like you say, the cinematography, Beau Welch's production design, yeah. which is influenced by JFK Airport and sort of the
space futurism. Age.
Yeah, retro-futurism. Tom Duffield's art direction, Cheryl Karasik's set direction, Mary Evoat's costume design, the aforementioned Rick Baker and team prosthetics and makeup, and then ILM's work and how those things all work together. So, like in Jurassic Park, how all the elements work together so seamlessly to make a pretty undeniable hole. Yeah. And it's just cool, man. It looks so cool. Big shout it's so out to sleek.
Rick Carter and JP as well. I forgot yeah. his name for a second, but it's just coming.
But I think one of the crucial things with that, and I think one of the reasons that it does linger on so well in a way that its own sequels don't, and pretty much every Sonnenfeld film since then struggles to do, is it has that element of grain to it. It has that, it's a filmic grain, but it's also, there's a grain to the atmosphere the film conjures up. We're obviously mm-hmm. not New Yorkers. I've been there once when I was in my early 20s, with my family, not in a way that I really experienced the proper New York. But a lot of New Yorkers, particularly on Letterboxd, do cite this as one of the New York movies,
yeah.
I think, for that time as well. And I think it is because it does feel very ground level. It does sort of get you in and dirty with what's going on in there. So I think Men in Black, the aesthetic of that thing.
Yeah.
Number one.
I'm quite like it.
You know what the difference is between you and me? I make this look good.
So, on a similar note then, we have our first dedicated awards category, and this is, of course, the Wax Splatter Award for Favourite Effects Shot.
Who's Wax Splatter, Josh? Wax Splatter
being the... Does he die in the movie? The late, yeah. great professor?
He does die. Yeah. Killed... He's the one who sees the birds in the pie?
Yeah, right, yeah. The late, great Professor Wax Splatter, of course, from Young Sherlock Holmes, the mm-hmm. film that kickstarted it's a 3D model, basically, yeah. in
so very, like,
CGI.
Big touchstone for visual effects, that movie. Yeah. Hence yeah. why we have decided to name this particular category after a character in that movie who had the funniest name.
Because
it's not even the character who gets killed by the stained glass knight.
No, they had a boring name.
They had a boring name. We just thought it'd be funnier if we called it the Wax Splatter yeah. Award. Are we wrong?
It even looks funny.
Yeah, it's spelled out. It's so flatter. Weird. Wax Splatter.
And it's funny to make... It's funny that deeply forgettable movie. Sorry to the legion of fans who keep listening to the episodes to this day.
It's one of the most popular episodes.
Ostensibly eminently forgettable, mm-hmm. but it has a really crucial place in the evolution of, and it also the group that worked on it split enough to make Pixar.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's huge. It's a huge cornerstone of a project
in development of visual effects. So this is our favorite effect shot, isn't it?
Yes.
So very much what you're seeing on the screen has been put together predominantly for visual effects, be that practical or computer wizardry. Not to start sounding like a bit of a broken drum, but again, there was only really one winner for me in this.
I wonder.
It's not an aforementioned shot from the film that we've already said, but it is another shot from within it that is often heralded as one of the iconic shots in the movie for its blend of everything. And that is the shot of the T-Rex stepping out of the paddock and escaping in between the two cars, staring around and letting out a big old roar.
Yeah. It's pretty fucking great.
Yeah. It helps that like it's at night and it's in the rain, so you can kind of blend the details a little bit more, but it still looks so damn good.
Yeah.
And that is, again, that kind of... Then going further in that sequence to kind of combine it with the animatronics that Stan Winston and his Creature Workshop made, and also combining the dinosaur animation model that Phil Tippett and his team had ended up making after really made redundant after being taken off of that movie.
Yeah.
After being hired to initially do them in stop motion, but then being brought on board to kind of act as animal behaviorists almost.
And yeah.
Creating a device that you could move and it would input the movement into the CG models that ILM were making to bring to life the world's greatest predator in fearsome glory. I don't think you can really get much better than that.
Dr. Grant.
Boy, my head been right all the time.
Again, pretty undeniable. So much of this is do we go for the big one that we sort of have to acknowledge, or do we go for something slightly less heralded? I don't know. I've gone weirdly in the middle, and I don't know if you'll push back against this, but mine is... It's a deeply, deeply, deeply simple... It's almost minimalist in every way that yours is maximalist.
Okay, I'm intrigued.
Same franchise.
Okay.
Next movie along. Okay. But I think it is the most effective effect... One of my favourite shots in this filmmaker's oeuvre, even though the film itself is not one that I like too much. And it is Julianne Moore on the window of a trailer that's suspended over a cliff and the glass very slowly cracking.
Mm-hmm.
I think it is just an ingenious... I don't know if that is something that had been done previously in a thriller or a horror film.
That, like, kind of matches that.
But it just feels...
The new Mission Impossible echoes it.
Yeah, it's an awful lot. And it is nail-biting intense, but it's the simplicity of this. It's all quiet, and it's the sound effect that goes with it, but it is the effect of wherever she puts her hand, you can see these little cracks coming out, and it's so... It's the closest he gets to Hitchcock.
Yeah, it's a very Hitchcock movie.
I just think, in all the ways that you say that the first movie's big effect shot is effective, this is similarly effective, but much more...
Mm-hmm.
Inward, it's much more human and small scale. That whole sequence is incredible.
It's so impressive, that sequence. Yeah.
I almost went in for the shot that follows Eddie into the trailer over his shoulder and Sam. But I watched it again, and it is much more fleeting. This is much more sustained.
Mm-hmm.
I just think it's so impressive for how small scale it is.
Yeah.
And I tried to find the name of the person responsible for that effect shot, but the effects team is so huge. Yeah. So I wasn't able to find it, but just ILM in general, terrific work.
To say my honourable mention for this one as well, because I think it's kind of in the spirit of why we kind of named this for young Sherlock Holmes. A tip of the hat to the work in Casper as well by ILM and the animation department on that one, because that's quite a significant visual effects moment. The first CG character brought to life as a like living, breathing co-star.
Yeah.
That there's no kind of underselling, just quite how big an achievement bringing to life a fully fledged CG character for the whole movie.
Yeah.
Is.
Also, my runner-up that I almost gave it to was, you have any idea how much that stings?
Tony Shalhoub's head growing back.
Jeeb's head exploding and regrowing. Seamless combination of Rick Baker's work with, again, the Wizard of Islander.
Indeed. So,
truly cannot see the seams.
Mm-hmm.
Don't move!
I'm coming down for you. Here I come. Stay still. Here I come, Sarah.
Nick, yeah. Satellite phone. Get it.
And with that, we come to another new category.
From the sublime to the ridiculous. This is one that we decided at the 11th hour to put in there because it's the only decade in which we can do this.
We can do this one.
I want to say now, I don't give a shit about this one.
We could be quite quick on this one, I think. For it is our favourite Amblimation film. for those of you who may not recall, that Amblimation is the short-lived animation wing of Amblin that was established in the early part of the decade, and despite plans to make many more films, they only ended up producing three. An American Tale, Fievel Goes West, We're Back, A Dinosaur Story, and Balto, all three of which underperformed, leading to the shutdown of the studio shortly after Balto's release in 1996.
Yes. Because it was on the videotape of Casper. No, 1995. December 95. Probably 96.
96
96 over here. Trepidation
there. But yes, so, Joshua Glenn, out of those three
Balto
films.
Only because it's less actively painful than the other two. But I don't like it. I think they're all rubbish.
My answer is also Balto, and it is the stronger of the three, but I fully agree. I still think it was great.
I think it's a sad case of it's an animation faction run, overseen by people that, this is unfair, let me rephrase it. It's an animation subdivision that is part of an organisation that doesn't really understand what an animation subdivision would require.
The up-up-ups didn't really get it.
Animators,
and didn't give the animators the kind of... Because there is
some, even in Fievel Goes West, which is probably, no, because We're Back's the worst, isn't it? Even in those two films, there are moments of beauty. There are really impressive images that they are able to conjure. I think Balto has the most of them, which is why that's the pick.
And Balto is the one that, like, at least kind of still, for the most part, operates as a movie.
And we had we had a bit of correspondence for it at the time. People since then have said things to us about how much it means to them and stuff, and how
it was
in their childhood.
So maybe the director video sequels.
Yeah.
No director video sequels for We're Back.
We're back, but not for long. Do we need to really?
No, I think not.
All we can really say is R.I.P. We'll not miss you, but.
You were a fascinating avenue to explore Amblimation.
You really were.
Best
laid plans of mice and Bluth often go awry.
This holiday season, join Rosie, Boris, Muck and Luck, Jenny.
It's beautiful.
And Balto.
Yeah, beautiful.
The dog with the heart of a hero. Balto, rated G. Now playing.
So this is a fun one. This is, much like last year, maybe my favourite one to research and remember. And this, of course, is favourite quote.
Mm.
So let's just get into this one. Andrew, what was your favourite quote? Or if there are honourable mentions, what are your almost rants?
There's a lot generally you can pick up from Jurassic Park. It's being very, very memorable lines to... quote, everyone kind of goes for the life finds way off, that often gets recycled, but I also think of one that I decided more to go with one with something that I think kind of really surmises just how good the overall script is and kind of embodies just what sort of kind of wit, but also quite like slightly higher brow intelligence that's kind of going on under the packaging, as it were, that you might not inherently expect from what you're seeing on the surface. And the quote I have gone with is Tommy Lee Jones responding to Will Smith's question of why don't you just tell people people are smart, to which Tommy Lee Jones goes,
a person is smart, people are dumb, panicky, dangerous animals, and you know it. 1500 years ago, everybody knew the earth was the center of the universe. 500 years ago, everybody knew the earth was flat, and 15 minutes ago you knew that people were alone on this planet.
Imagine what you'll know tomorrow.
Ed, so you could have thrown a dart at the quotes page on IMDb for Man in Black, and any of them would have been gold. It's such a...
And I remember that was a quote that really got like circulated around when like COVID broke out. It's just kind of being that a lot of the reactionary things that we were seeing around that time, and just how it does kind of speak to like a wider kind of like culture that has only become more relevant to kind of point out. As a kind of summation for hysteria. That is when I really sat down and thought about it, a quote that really encapsulates a very, very strong script. And that's one I often think about in everyday life. So
yeah,
it's that one from Men in Black.
This was a bit of a struggle. I knew I was going to mention Men in Black anyway, but I ultimately had to just write that one off because it's going to get a lot of mentions in this episode. Uh-huh. And I was kind of hoping that you would have gone for it as well. So I focused my attention elsewhere. The one that's, I think, stuck in, this is not my choice, but the one that stuck in my head probably the most since watching it was Dr. Catheter receiving a delivery and saying, ah, splendid, this must be my malaria. Rabies. I've got rabies. And then I really undernarred between several from To Wong Fu.
Yeah, that's so really good.
No one say anything frivolous in the next few moments. I'm having a significant moment. I think of you as an angel. I think that's healthy.
I think that's healthy.
Jane Mansfield. Not a good audio auto reference. But in the end, I did return to Joe vs. the Volcano because when I thought more about that film, as well as visually, there's a lot of pithy little clever, but also feeling out something deeply existential.
Mind.
Feels like something very existential, and it gets to this sense of ennui and the absurdity of living in this sort of modern world that just exists to drive you to the ends of the earth. And it's when Joe's at the doctor and he says,
I'm not sick except for this terminal disease.
Which has no symptoms. That's right. It was only because of your insistence on having so many tests that we happened to discover the problem.
Because it's a little bit smart ass, but it also sort of diagnoses the human condition in this very, very smart way. And
live it well. You only have, like, what is it? You only have 10 days left in this world.
Something like that, yeah.
So, my advice, live it well.
Yeah. Also, when he's flirting on the luggage and looking at the moon, and he says, I never realised how big, and then just sort of trails off.
It's a
deeply affecting film. But I think that one sums up what Shanley gets so right in that movie, and why that movie is so, so gosh darn resonant and deserves much more love.
Yeah.
Really is fantastic, isn't it? I've been thinking about that film a lot today. And it's bonkers that he didn't make another film until Doubt, which was 14, 15, whatever, years later on, and you know, then it was Wild Mountain Time.
Wild Mountain Time.
There's one when Ms. Tatham was in the room, for reasons that listeners will find out soon enough, she was looking over my notes, and she saw that I didn't have this one and said, you must mention this one
okay.
if Andy doesn't pick it. And I wondered if you might.
The one that she was like, say this was mine.
Yeah. and the quote that Emily would have chosen is, I think World War II is my favourite war.
Of course. The late
has
great
to be. Yeah.
As, oh, what's that family surname again?
Hang on, so I have got it later on. It is Fimple. He's Phil Fimple. He will come up again later on. The next one is our third
new
four new categories.
And again, one that will only be really pertinent to this decade.
we'll adapt it. We'll adapt it for the next one. And this one is most 90s of the 90s.
Most
so
90s of the 90s.
This, I believe, was your suggestion. So you
I think it was, yeah.
Take the wheel, define what this is,
yeah.
and tell us what you have chosen and why.
I think, for me, when thinking of this category, I would say it's like... So the 90s is, and I'm sure we're not the only ones, it's a decade of films, and the more I look over them, and it's something we touched on particularly in our last episode on In Dreams, which is a very 90s movie, but not my choice for most 90s
also
of the 90s.
Same.
Yeah. even when it's trash, there's still like a kind of personality to it that really shines through.
Yeah.
Because they often are still quite weird.
Even yeah.
The really rubbish movies are still quite weird. Even like particularly like even franchise stuff, like even thinking out of this, Batman and Robin,
yeah.
inherently not a good film, but it's quite weird doing something...
Tactility
yeah,
there. We always make the tactility
band.
Of it, yeah.
And, yeah, there's just something that, like, particularly for this decade, there's a lot that you can kind of point towards as, like, hallmarks for the sort of things that you don't really get now. So that's what I was kind of thinking. What is something that encapsulates a sense of the ingredients in a movie that you kind of get now but don't, and this is the sort of thing that really... could only exist in the 90s. And for me, it kind of came down to the idea of like the logline, like thriller, like action
elevated
movie.
Pitch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And for me, the one that really encapsulates the 1990s, for better and for worse, is Young DeBont's Twister.
Yeah.
Because it is just like, what if Storm chases? and their divorce and squabbling and chasing storms.
What if His Girl Friday? Chasing storms.
And it's got an incredibly 90s cast. Bill Paxton, the late great Bill Paxton.
Yeah.
Helen Hunt, Philip Seymour Hoffman, Gary Elwes. it's just one of those ones. And then a score that features like original guitar riffs and created specifically for the film by Van Halen.
Yeah, yeah.
And again, it's just, it's a action movie that's like gets really into that tactility and tech as well.
Yeah.
A lot of the tech that was like shown in the film
yeah.
was like, oh, it's so 90s. Look at them throwing out those chunky laptops.
Very blocky.
Yeah.
Edgy.
And then also it's like, it has that element that I think is incredibly 90s where you have the effort from everyone involved to be pushing the envelope of CGI whilst also maintaining a sense of groundedness by having it still be shot on location and having you work with real materials to then use CG to further flesh out certain scenes or to just bring something to the image that you just can't get in real life, to an effectiveness that has been lost.
Yeah.
Now there's just... it's rarely an attempt to, particularly on this kind of level of like an $100 million blockbuster, to be like, let's make sure that we're getting in on the ground level of the CG guys and making sure that every design element is being thought out on set first and then build them into the process as early as possible. That in this kind of like headless chicken race of blockbuster filmmaking where everything costs $200 million now. Not to be heartening on about like films today, but like there is something that's missing by there clearly being more of a preference to be like, just shoot it on the green screen and we'll fill it in later. Yes, they're of course thinking about camera movement and lighting and making sure all that matches, but there is something missing by not having a lot more real elements in there. And whilst Twister is one of those 90s films that I was really hoping I would love revisiting, but it fell a bit short for me, and I found it a bit irritating. all its charms, I think, are inherently very 1990s.
Yeah. I fully agree.
It's coming!
The critics are blown away.
Get out of there!
A one-of-a-kind experience like Jaws and Jurassic Park. You have never seen anything like it before. Truly amazing. Twister, rated PG-13. Now playing at a theater near you.
But I went for a different one, ultimately, because this film is an exemplar of the kind of film that you really don't see on this level anymore. And it had a cultural impact in a way that I know certainly influenced you and I hugely, even if the film itself hasn't necessarily. I choose Cape Fear
Interesting.
For this one, because it's sort of, again, to use the word that I've used many times before, it's maximalist in this very 90s way that you don't really see this kind of thriller. What
I don't know why you've gone for this.
You know why I've gone for this. But I think I've been listening to Karina Longworth's, you must remember this season on the erotic 90s right now. She's talking a lot about the Joe Estahaz kind of erotic thriller, Basic Instinct and...
Showgirls.
What's the other one? Showgirls, like Jade as well. And this is not, you know, it's not an erotic thriller, but it certainly has that sort of coked out sweatiness quality to it, this film. And to have something so unencumbered, so almost Grand Guignol in its grotesquerie, this movie, you just don't really have that on that level anymore. And that kind of film did reach a mainstream peak, I think, in the 90s. And it's decidedly... I
mean, that film made nearly $200 million.
Yeah, it's decidedly un-Amblin. But I think that it is a very representative 90s film.
Yeah.
And maybe for no reason more than the fact that it led to a parody in an animated sitcom that is still running to this day, but was inarguably at its peak in the 1990s. And that is, of course, the episode of The Simpsons, Cape Fear, which is arguably more culturally pervasive than the film itself.
The Simpsons also did a Twisters riff in the 90s. A film, again, which also, to also point my point, Twister the film and like reading into it had that weird kind of like Twister fever kind of
feeling,
where it was like a genuine like phenomenon.
Yeah.
Which stuff doesn't quite happen in quite the same like sticking power
these days.
It's more like 2 weeks doing well at the box office and then the next thing's a lot.
Well, the nearest thing you have is, I suppose maybe 10 years ago, episodic television was like Breaking Bad, for instance, but even that is rarer and rarer. You have a succession every five or so. Something will capture the imagination like Succession every 5 or so years. But that was a surprise that show held on for so long in the public consciousness. Because now we've moved on to What the Bear, which they dropped all of season 12 in a day, and that's going to fade away in a week's time. So you're right. Like what is that cultural focus has changed. But in the 90s, it was, you're right. But you are right. Like I think Twister represents a very different kind of film that the 90s were ubiquitous with. But I think Cape Fear also exemplifies a kind of film that the 90s were ubiquitous with. And it has maybe the most famous parody that is also ubiquitous with the 90s. So either or. I could take either.
Either or.
Also, Trigger Effect to a similar degree.
Absolutely.
And also in Dreams.
And also in Dreams.
Wow. Public library. We'll stay here for a while, Vern.
Oh, that man is so rude.
Yeah. If you don't mind, we're trying to watch the movie.
Hey, Vern, help me get my head out of this toilet.
Oh, really? Now that's too much.
Ah! Sideshow Bob!
Halt, who goes there?
Greetings. I am Andy, emissary of the Rambler Knights. No big deal. You have now reached the end of part one of our 90s review, Lollapalooza. Keep an eye on your podcast catcher of choice next week, when we'll be back with part two, diving into such unmissable categories as the Good Boy Award for Best Dog, Biggest Cry, and the Dick Miller Award for Favorite Bit Player. We'll also be partaking in a little quiz and revealing both ours and the listeners' top fives of the decade. To be concluded.
Great Scott!
Doc! Doc!
that one is. Oh. Yes.